The Hard Shoulder on News Talk
with Nissan. Let's go the distance by keeping our distance. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
All right, we're continuing now to focus on people's heroes, their inspirational figures. Now, last week we had Senator David Norris. We're asking people, it can be someone that they've actually met in their life that has lifted them and inspired them, or someone that just is a public figure, either in contemporary living or historically, who has inspired them. It's a great pleasure to welcome criminologist and crime journalist Paul Williams to tell us. So we're going to start with someone who not everybody will know, your first nominee. It's retired state solicitor Barry Galvin. Why is he a hero?
Well, he's my walking, talking, living hero and has been for many, many years, Ivan. Barry Galvin, a certain number of amount of people will remember. Barry was the former state solicitor for Cork, but he was also the principal architect of the legislation that set up the Criminal Assets Bureau and was their first the first legal officer. Basically, he was one of the main forces, the driving forces of the Criminal Assets Bureau for its first 15 years in operation, and he made it ultimately the success that it is.
And is he still alive? Where does he live? Or is he
Barry
retired?
Barry lives in Cork. His family still, the family business. He's the third generation of the Galvin legal family, which are an old blue chip, old money legal firm in Cork. And now there's a fifth generation joining the business, but he's retired there, supposedly retired. Although his family have some difficulty in trying to keep him in his place. I'll just give you his background. He, as I say, he comes from a very long legal family history. His granddad in 1859 qualified as a solicitor in the Law Society and actually got the Law Society Gold Medal, went on then to fight in the trenches in France during the First World War. Barry himself became a lawyer. He passed with top of his class in the bar exams in King's Inns in 1965, and he was actually placed first in the Roll of Honour and was awarded the prestigious Brooke Prize at the time. But he then worked in the field of corporate banking and taxation law, and then for a time was a criminal defence lawyer, until in 1983 he became the state solicitor for Cork. And one of the things about Barry Galvin is, and this I think is why he's a hero and why people like him are heroes, is that he went above and beyond to a level of courage and commitment and dedication to his profession and to the state that is a very, very rare trait in the vast majority of people. And why should you? He quite literally, this man put his neck on the line. In 1992, you may remember this, Ivan. In 1992, he very famously went on the Late Late Show. He was, after spending something like 8 years as the state solicitor in Cork, he could see trends in organised crime, but he could also see how Ireland was becoming a very attractive place for international organised criminal drug gangs to operate from. The coastline was unprotected, largely. And a lot of these people had come to live here and base themselves here. And money laundering was very natural because there was no laws or any kind of initiative or any kind of legislation there to take them on. So it became very much Ireland, a thieves' paradise. And so he was being ignored all the time in his discussions with the Department of Justice. So in 1992, he very famously went on the Late Late Show. And what he achieved in doing that that night was to, for the first time ever, to really lay bare and to give a full, comprehensive picture of the state of organised crime that was burgeoning organised crime at the time. And he was an impeccable source because he was on the front line. And very prophetically at the time, he said that the only way to really deal with this incipient crisis that was coming down the track was to establish a single agency which would combine the skills of, say, customs, revenue and Gardaí. Similar, he said at the time, to the Drug Enforcement Agency. And he was asked by Gayborn, would you run it? He said, sure, I'd have no problem running it. But at the time, he not only incurred the displeasure of criminals and people like that, but he also very significantly incurred the serious displeasure of the then Fianna Fáil Justice Minister, P. Flynn. And he basically tried to set him out or deride him as a crank who was motivated by a political allegiance to Fine Gael. Even though he was doing a patriotic duty and telling the people of Ireland there is a problem here. And then he launched what was launched from Garda headquarters at the time was the most bizarre operation, where they were basically went to dig up any dirt they could find on Barry Galvin so that the government could discredit him. And the reason why was because he had embarrassed everybody by telling the truth about what organised crime was like. And I remember back in 1992, senior Gardaí would frown on you and admonish you and give out to you for even using the term organised crime. There was no such thing as organised crime, they were saying. And very significantly, Flynn in the Dáil got up on his hind legs. I'm sure you had to sit many times and listen to his eloquence yourself when you were in the Dáil. And he basically said, the State Solicitor for Cork, I've written it down here, the State Solicitor for Cork has been questioned about his allegations. And then he said, there is a problem with drugs in Ireland, but it is not of the scale as promulgated by Barry Galvin. So Barry Galvin was slapped down and he continued in his job and he went quiet and continued to work with the Gardaí very, very closely in Cork and continued working in a way that other state solicitors weren't. He was going after, he was trying to find legislative loopholes and trying to find lines in acts where the Gardaí could go and chase after criminals in any way he could. Now, you bring him on then to 1996. His prophecies came to be fulfilled quite in blood, quite literally, and that was with the blood of Veronica Guerin, who was murdered in June of 1996. And after that, the Fine Gael and Labour government decided we really do need to do something about these guys. And the big issue was, and remember, Gilligan's gang murdered Veronica because she was questioning where he was getting his money. And at this stage, let me just to contextualise what was going on up to this stage before Veronica was murdered, you had people like Martin Cahill, the general, when he was investigated for his obvious wealth from criminality and had his dole cut, he went and abducted Brian Purcell, who was the senior Department of Social Welfare inspector dealing with his case at the time, and had him abducted in the middle of the night and shot in the legs. He, six years earlier, blew up the state forensic scientist, Dr. James Donovan. When John Gilligan was being pursued by the Revenue, he literally told them to F off, and they F'd off. And the point about it was that civil servants, quite rightly, were too scared to take on these people because they were prepared to blow anyone away. You bring it up to Veronica's murder, she's murdered because Gilligan didn't want to lose his money and didn't want anyone writing about his financial affairs. And then everybody realised, my God, we have an issue here. And the first person they turned to was Barry Galvin. And Barry, he sat down with Rory Quinn and Nora Owen, who were the two principal ministers. Rory was the Minister for Finance and Nora was the Minister for Justice. And he basically hammered out the template that was used for the Proceeds of Crime Act, which gave and empowered this superb organisation, the Criminal Assets Bureau, which was, as he had said to Gay Byrne in 1992, shall be made up of Customs, Revenue and Gardaí. And also he suggested, for example, legislation which could amalgamate and open up, for example, the Revenue Commissioners, the Customs, the Social Welfare and the Gardaí, so that they could share information and were no longer withholding this information in silos. And it's very, very hard for people today of a certain age to think that at one time, criminals, for example, could live in a massive house in the countryside, could have race horses, could drive the top-of-the-range car, could rob as many banks as they want, and as long as they weren't caught, they could lodge it in their bank accounts and nobody could touch it. And then they could go in every Thursday and collect their dole money. And this was the way the life was at the time, and the civil servants were afraid to take them. And that's why you had Barry Galvin, who quite literally became Ireland's version of Elliot Ness.
No. He finished up in the CAB in 2003 and then went back to be a state solicitor in Cork, which position he held up until 2013 when he statutorily retired. Is that right?
Yeah, and in the meantime, he went to the Seychelles, where he ran a money laundering investigation unit for the Seychelles government for several years. And he caused, to say that he sent ripples around the global money laundering markets was putting it
mildly. Was there ever a threat on his life? Was he ever nearly killed or attacked?
Again, this is why he quite literally is our Elliot Ness and why he is, in my eyes, an impeccable and great patriot who should be honoured. He, when he got involved with CAB, the first thing the mob did was try to kill him. He is the only civilian, non-Garda, to be issued with a 38 Smith & Wesson revolver. And you see these extraordinary scenes of Barry coming into court with his jacket bulging widely. He'd have a bunch of documents, like every other lawyer, on the one arm. And on the other arm, you could see his jacket bulging out where his gun was hanging on his hip to shoot the first guy who tried to shoot him. His office and his home had to be specially adapted and protected. Like, for example, his office was made bomb-proof on South Mall in Cork. He was allowed to drive squad cars. He was under himself. He, even though he had a gun, he was still protected and escorted by two cops. He worked day and night.
He was never injured?
No, he wasn't. And I wouldn't like to see what would have happened if some of those guys had to actually take off one of our plans, because Barry would have flattened them. You know, this was a man, as I say, from an old legal firm, an old blue-chip legal firm, one of the first in the country, in Cork, and he didn't have to do this, and he didn't certainly earn the money that he deserved, that he should have earned.
For outstanding historic contribution to public service, for courage, for ability and for perseverance, Barry Galvin is your first nominee. Now, your second nominee is also a Corkman. He only lived to be 32, but is perhaps one of our best figures in Irish history, Michael Collins.
Well, he is everybody's hero, and I was asked to, you know, my visceral reaction was to... Michael Collins, of course, probably the first hero everybody has had. Like, he has been voted the most patriotic and the most famous and heroic Irishman of all time, and quite deservedly. So I think, you know, everybody knows the story intuitively of Michael Collins, so I'm not going to go back into it again. But I was always taken and hugely admiring of his, you know, his intellect, his incredible organisational genius. He was very charismatic, charming networker. I think the greatest tragedy in our state, in our history, is the fact that the man who fought so hard to liberate Ireland from the clutches of imperialism was himself then murdered by his own. And his famous line in the Dáil, you know, in my opinion, it gives us freedom. This is the treaty. It gives us freedom, not the ultimate freedom that all nations desire, but the freedom to achieve it. And basically that sentiment was echoed ultimately in the Good Friday Agreement. The man who had been derided by the murderers and the people who indulged in needless carnage in Northern Ireland for all those years. Forget about Sunningdale for slow learners in 1972. Michael Collins had laid out a template whereby there would have been lasting peace on this island. I think that we would not have had the protectionist economic policies of De Valera. We wouldn't have had the Anglo-Irish economic war of the 1930s, which was a complete bloody disaster. We wouldn't have had the isolation of the 40s and then the decay and stultification of the 50s, which, and all of that. I basically think if Michael Collins hadn't been murdered, I think that the people of Ireland would not have suffered the unnecessary socioeconomic hardship and the heartache.
Okay, Paul, I get all that, but... Sorry, this is recording, Roisin. Yeah. Okay, Paul, I get all that, but who knows? I mean, he died at 32. Mm. His achievements in that short span were incredible. But I put it to you that it's a bit like Princess Diana. You know, nothing boosts your obituary like dying young.
Well, I think that all the evidence is slightly different to that. I think there is evidence to back up what I'm saying and what everybody else thinks about Michael Collins as a hero. You know, the Civil War, the Civil War, if it had not taken place, that huge tragedy, which drove the new nascent state into penury from the very beginning, I think that we would have had a much brighter past than we've had. And remember as well how he said, you know, this man, when he signed the treaty, he said, I believe I have signed my own death warrant. And he did.
But
and
as
he did
you know, as you know,
he was doing.
But there is a flip side to this. There was a huge anti-treaty element to society. The treaty was divisive. Mm-hmm. And De Valera went on to have a distinguished and very long career as Taoiseach and President, and he was on the opposite side to Collins.
Well, I'd say to you that, he had one foot in and one foot out for a while. we wouldn't have suffered the stultifying decades that we did if Michael Collins was here. If Michael Collins was a man who would, instead of retreating behind our borders, Michael Collins would have, like, he was a man who believed, for example, that being pro-Irish didn't mean being anti-British. He didn't agree, and he didn't allow himself to be blinded by this obdurate hatred for perfidious Albion. He could see that these are nearest neighbour, that we would be pragmatic and deal with them. And I believe that he would have brought the unionists in the north around at some stage, because I think he would have been a reconciliatory voice. And I think as well, if we hadn't gone down, I know it's a great tragedy, we can't rewrite history here, but if we hadn't gone down the road of the horrible civil war, then Ireland would have been a much stronger nation starting off, growing up.
Finally and briefly, you have one additional nominee, which is a relative of yours, your uncle, Seamus Williams.
Well, Uncle Seamus, he was my family hero, I suppose. I was exceptionally close to him. He died in when I was 13, quite young. He ran the family business, and our family were involved in the rock drilling business. And Uncle Seamus was the patriarch of the family, because his dad, my granddad, died in 1943, and Seamus was 19 at the time. And he was the eldest of nine siblings, and the youngest was about five, and one of the other younger children, my Aunt Nan, had Down syndrome. And he died, and there was nothing. And I remember famously, my granny, I've been told this by many, many people in Carrigallen and Leitrim, where our family are from, that she famously, the day that they buried granddad, she said to Seamus, what are we going to do? And he said, "Ma'am, we're going to be fine." And he spent the rest of his life, until he was 54 and taken so young from us, working literally day and night to mind his family and to build a very successful business. And he and I were very, very close. He had no kids. He was married. He had no kids. He was living with my granny and my Aunt Nan. And when he wasn't working, he was reading history. And when he was reading history, I spent all my weekends, all my holidays there with him. And we would discuss history all day and all night. And he allowed me when I was 10 that these drilling rigs, which are big machines. And when I was 10, he used to allow me to drive them around the place, much to the absolute annoyance of my mum and dad and my granny and everybody. But he was my hero, and he died at a very sensitive time in my life. By the way, he was also a teetotaler. He didn't smoke. He was very religious. I suppose he had me earmarked to take over the family business. A lot of people said that if I had gone down that route with him, perhaps he would have ended up killing me, because I was not as conservative, shall we say, as he was, and a bit more of a party animal. But he died when I was 13, and it had a huge effect on my life after that. Now, my granny died a couple of months after that, and it had a huge effect on the entire family. And I suppose I went a bit off the rails after that for a while.
Well, some say you've never got back on the rails.
And then ended up in journalism. Jesus. I was a real disappointment to my Uncle Seamus. But he was one of my heroes. And it's very rare that you get asked to do this.
I want to thank the three heroes, the inspirational figures who have touched the life of Paul Williams, were Michael Collins, who would be well known, the amazing story of the courage of Barry Galvin, and finally, the direct impact in the family business and his upbringing of his uncle, Seamus Williams. My sincere thanks to Paul, and we are continuing this mini-series of people, and it really tells about their own life and their own experiences, and it is very frank and revealing.
The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk
with Nissan. Together, let's play our part by staying apart. Nissan. Innovation that excites.